Folkcast Interview Special, number 005. It's Phil Beer from Show of Hands. Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Folkcast. I'm your host, Phil Widows. In this show, I'll be talking to the multi-instrumentalist and singer Phil Beer, best known for his work with Steve Knightley in the duo Show of Hands. But if you only know Phil from Show of Hands, there's much more to his musical life than that. Indeed, he's a man with many fingers in many pies. He runs his own band. He's also a member of the Festival Favourites Feast of Fiddles. He has his own record label. He's a producer for other artists. And he's about to join the musical elite by having a box set of his music released. And, I noticed, as I trawled his website, he's even tried his hand at podcasting. Amazingly, he gave all that up, well, at least for a few months, to run away to sea aboard the sailing vessel the Pegasus in the annual Tall Ships Race, helping to crew the ship for 9 weeks and visiting 12 countries. But now he's back, and Show of Hands have a new album on release titled Arrogance, Ignorance and Greed, and they're also doing a major UK tour, taking in the county towns of England throughout October, November and into December. I called Phil on the phone and started off by asking him about his recent nautical adventures. But first, to get us in the mood, here's Show of Hands with a song of theirs from 1990. This is the suitably titled Tall Ships.
Sweet thoughts of home came to me today. Far too long now I've been away. I'll stay. Sight of the West Country shore, we swear we won't go to sea anymore. Sweethearts and wives seem dearer as the English shore draws nearer. Now soon they're welcome with warm winter's heart. We'll vow nothing will pull us apart. There'll be a short time of plenty. We'll think again when our pockets are empty.
It's Phil Beer. Hello, mate. How are you?
Phil Beer, welcome to Folkcast. We'll be talking later about your new album with Show of Hands and the tour that you're going on. But first of all, I thought we'd listen to your tales of adventure on the high seas and start off by asking, why did you go? I understand it was a lifelong dream to actually go to sea on a proper tall ship sailing vessel?
Oh, yeah. I mean, more so recently as one gets older. I was very lucky when I went to school. There was nothing particularly special about my school, but it was by the sea in Tynmouth. And we had lots of opportunities to go sailing and doing stuff, you know. There was a small school sailing club run by a very motivated woodwork teacher, actually. Mm-hmm. And while I was at that school, they actually built a sail. The club actually built its own sailing dinghy.
Oh, yeah.
And then we had another teacher who was a chap who was actually special boat services during the war, mm-hmm. and he ran a sort of boat yard over at Sheldon with several boats. And he was sort of, let's say, special boat services and so on. So he was a pretty keen sailor, and he used to take us off sailing as well. So I just had all those opportunities and sort of, you know, I was... After doing a little bit of conventional work for the first 2 or 3 years of my life, I was a musician from age like 20, 24 onwards. Mm-hmm. And apart from isolated incidents, you know, you just never get these opportunities.
Mm.
And then occasionally something manifests itself, and then something else gets in the way, you know. And it's especially that thing often over, you can't really take any time out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You may be sitting around twiddling your thumbs, because nothing's happening, but when the phone rings, you've got to jump, you know.
Sure.
And I think there've been 2 or 3 occasions in my life where there's been a very strong possibility of going away for several months and doing a major sale, and then something too important has always come up to sort of supersede it.
Mm.
So this time it was very carefully planned. I knew pretty much a year in advance that this opportunity was going to happen. And so I managed to organise with my compatriots to actually take the summer off.
Which is very nice to be able to do that. I mean, do you sail anyway? Do you have a boat of your own at all?
No, I don't. Well, I don't have a sailing boat at the moment. I will do next season. I've got a couple of boats on the River Exe. I go fishing, and because we have nice pubs down the river as well.
Mm.
So, and the quickest way to get to a couple of them is by boat. So, so I'm often out and about, you know, and I go sailing occasionally with other people. But, of course, having now done tall ships and come back again, I'm actually looking at a traditional boating, but a wooden yacht of some description. I'm narrowing it down now. So, but there's 2 or 3, I've been looking at 2 or 3 very, very nice sailboats. And,
mm-hmm.
of course, people don't want them these days, mm-hmm. unless you're an absolute wooden boat enthusiast, I mean, because of the maintenance.
Sure,
know.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got to have a month of TLC every year, you know, just to keep them afloat, you know. But they're,
mm-hmm.
ultimately, they're much more satisfying than anything modern. So.
Yeah.
We'll see.
My wife Jo and I were down in Falmouth last year.
Oh, okay.
And we saw the tall ships, and the tall ships race came to town.
Yeah.
And they're astonishing, wonderful, picturesque things, aren't they? And if you don't have a hankering to go to sea before you see the tall ships, you soon do once they come to sight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. To be realistic, of course, the term tall ships actually still technically covers anything that sails.
All right.
If you see what I mean. The tall ships race as such. There's 170 vessels in it. Only 13 of them are actually, you know, clipper size.
Mm.
Because there aren't obviously that many working in the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's always the two Russians, the Sedov and the Mir. I think they are the two largest in existence, I believe. I may be wrong about that. But yes, the tall ships is personified by those 13 or 14 ships in Class A. But we're actually in Class B. We're a traditional boat. We're a Bristol pilot cutter. In fact, we're only 70 foot long,
only
one mast, you know. And that's a whole different kettle of fish, you know, especially when you're bashing across the North Sea,
mm-hmm.
in a full gale, you know, it's seat of the pants stuff, you know, and we survived one or two fairly heavy duty incidents without harm, but yeah, but Class B is the class that our boat's in, the Pegasus. She's 70 odd foot long. She's a Bristol pilot cutter, crew of 12 overall, and she's a fantastic thing. Of course, she's very fast, you see, in comparison. You know. And, of course, more versatile. The smaller boats are more versatile because clippers are very much dictated. Yeah. If the wind's in the wrong direction, you're knackered, basically. Whereas there's a little bit more leeway with smaller boats that can sail closer to the wind.
So, yeah, sure, sure. Was everybody on board in the same position as you in that they'd never done it before, or was there an established crew that helped you out?
No. The boat has two standing crew, obviously the skipper and the mate, Diggory Rose and Amy Ferguson. And then there were two or three people like me who simply were paying their way, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. A friend of ours from North Devon called Vanessa Whip, who already has her yacht master's qualification anyway. So, you know, she's done some fairly serious exams. And there was another friend of ours on, just like me, paying on. And then, of course, the crux of it is the trainees, basically, young people, because you can't actually enter a boat in tall ships unless there are a series of young trainees on board. And this is where the whole sort of charitable funding thing comes in, basically, because, of course, the money has to be found to pay for them to be to be away for 9 weeks doing this, you know. And I did a bit of fundraising, did a couple of gigs, and several people who I'm involved with in various things came forward and stumped up some money, you know. So we were able to raise the funds for these five lads from Liverpool to come on the boat and actually do the whole thing. So that's the crux of tall ships, certainly. That's also what our boat, and to be honest, most sailing boats of this type do, basically, is sail training type work for young people, be it schools or you know, occasionally some of the boats we know are chartered by the army and so on and so forth. But it's all basically about young people and sail training.
Yeah, it's fantastic, yeah. What about you, Phil? Did you leave your musical life at home when you went to sea, or did you take some of it with you? Did you take an instrument or maybe two?
Yeah, took a cheap Chinese violin and a guitar, a beat-up old guitar. I have to say they were dead useful. We had some phenomenal sing-songs on a lot of other boats whilst we were in various ports. Very memorable in St. Petersburg. I was somebody's birthday present for the evening on another sail training boat, a big modern yacht called the John Lang. We did a concert on, which was fantastic. And in all sorts of places, all sorts of sing-songs on all sorts of different boats. And a terrific time. I should point out our skipper, Diggory Rose, is the son of the late Tony Rose, who's a very well West Country folk singer.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone who was very important to us when we were younger, you know. Someone we learned a lot of songs from, in fact. So Diggory is a bit of a singer himself, obviously. It's in the genes, and he knows a song or two.
I ran away from Padstow Town and shipped aboard a whaler.
Songs of the Sea have been part of your repertoire for a long time now anyway, but have your nautical adventures inspired you to write more of that kind of music?
Yeah, I did, you know, in this digital age, I took a high-quality little digital recorder with me, and I put down a lot of bits and pieces which I will work on for something, a project later on next year. But yeah, lots of new tunes, snippets of new songs, and and things. It's very inspirational, you know. And so, yes, there will probably in about a year's time be a bunch of new material for me personally that comes out of this experience.
Excellent stuff. Excellent. Right, so you're back on dry land now, and just about about to resume the touring life with a new album in the bag. I imagine that much of that album was recorded, written before you went away, or Steve was writing songs while you were away. What was the process of recording it? How soon did you record it after you got back?
Oh, well, I didn't do anything when I returned. Several of the songs we've been playing in for quite a long time, but of course the recording process is such a different thing these days, you know. In a sense, I personally find it much more creative because you can supply so much information in recording that can then be taken up or discarded, if you know what I mean. It's not a case of, you know, okay, there's a fiddle solo here, and so you end up running it maybe five or six times, you play it, and then three or four months down the line, you're not happy with it. What you do in the modern recording process, which is, of course, all digital and completely computer-orientated, is that no one minds if you play the solo 20 times, you know. And then it's an executive decision, in this case not my decision, because I was away. I put myself completely in the hands of the current producer, in this case was Stuart Hanna, to make the choices. But before I went away, I spent 3 weeks in the studio putting down hours and hours and hours of overdubs and bits and pieces, and sort of left them to it, basically.
So you gave them the jigsaw puzzle pieces, and they put them together.
It is like putting together. It's a little bit more coordinated than a jigsaw puzzle, in that someone like Stuart knows all the songs extremely well and has a very clear idea of where he'd like it to go. See, we've been making albums for a long time, and of course, there's a tendency not really to rely on production and so on in making of albums. And having made so many records, I think we logically, with in-house, gone as far as we could go, basically. Our original sound engineer and manager, Gerard O'Farrell, was very instrumental in creating our sound. And then subsequently, three or four albums with Mick Dolan, who was then our subsequent sound engineer, and is also a very good producer. But it was always a collective thing. So really, we broke the mold with the previous album, the Witness album, when we brought in the Afrikelts guys to try and, you know, put a new slant on what we do, and that was such an enjoyable experience and a hugely successful thing for us. We were delighted with the Witness album and the way it came out, that we felt that we can't go backwards from that. So, I think it's one of those situations where we'll probably end up using a different producer every single time that we make a studio album from now on. And so we're delighted with Stuart's approach to our music. Ironically, there's a huge amount of production been involved in this album, and yet the album actually sounds incredibly raw, you know, and that's very, very interesting. When I got home, got my sort of close to mastered copy and put it on, I was actually quite surprised, you know. I spent probably three or four days doing huge orchestral parts to four songs, and I left with the feeling, I hope they're not going to make four big orchestral sounding tracks on the album. And the way Stuart's dealt with all that stuff has actually worked out extremely well, you know. It doesn't sound like it's an album that's inundated with a million violin overdubs or anything like that. He's just done it right, you know. So personally, I'm very happy.
Great. Tell me about this this title track, Arrogance, Ignorance and Greed. You've stolen my title, because I was going to do a compilation album of all the songs that have been written about the banking crisis and the MP's expenses, of which there are about 300,000, I think.
Yeah.
It's something that's really struck a nerve with, with everybody, but especially with musicians. They seem to have really been turned onto it.
If people write songs generally have to be about something, you know, and in this genre, much far more so than, we already know what the themes of most popular music are. It's a little bit sort of grey and monosyllabic, you know. Boy meets girl, you know, falls in love, falls out of love, things go bad. It's kind of, it's the universal theme for most pop music. Whereas the kind of music we deal in, you know, it takes stuff from everything that's going on around you. So it was inevitable that this song like this would come out, I think. And Steve would certainly well, he wrote it, so you know, that's what he'd say.
All I wanted was a home and a roof over our head, somewhere we could call our own. Safer in our beds. There was a storm of money raining down. It only touched the ground. With a loan I took I can't repay, and the crock of gold you found. At every trough you stopped to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. I never was a cautious man. I spend more than I'm paid. But those with something put aside are the ones that you betrayed. With your bonuses and expenses, you shoveled down your throat. Now you bit the hand that fed you. Dear God, I hope you choke. At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. You're on your yacht, we're on our knees. For your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. The toxics bring you tapped and sold, poisoned every watering hole. Your probity you exchange for sets his price. No feather bed, no golden neck, no one pays him twice. So where's your thrift and your caution and your honest sound advice? You know you dealt yourself a winning hand and loaded every dice. At every trough you stop to feed, your ignorance and greed. I pray one day we'll soon be free from your absolute indifference, your avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
So, yeah, it's funny. Obviously, there have been one or two songs of ours that have been controversial in the past and certainly misinterpreted in certain quarters. However, universally, no one has yet actually had a go at us for taking pot shots at bankers. So that's an interesting one.
That's right. Presumably, you do have some bankers who are come to show hands gigs. They're going to be squirming, aren't they?
Yeah, but I was only saying this the other night because, of course, it's slightly unfair. The bankers we're talking about, you know, are the big boys who manipulate money. We're not talking about your high street bank manager.
No.
You know, of several of whom I know, you know, personally. And so it's a bit fair to just really, you know, to use a generic term like that. But, hey, that's the way it goes. So
that's right. One thing about your song is it's very radio-friendly, very catchy. I can imagine it being played on mainstream pop radio.
Yeah, and also it's the exception of musically, you see. It actually doesn't sit with the rest of the songs, because it clearly is a bit of a country rock track, and nothing else on the album goes there. But it also, very much for me, it's a slight homage. Only in that, I mean, like so many people of my age group who learned to play the fiddle, we were inspired by the obvious people, and probably one of the main people would have to be Dave Swarbrick, you know, who just influenced generation after generation of fiddle players. But my second influence beyond that was actually an American musician called David Lindley, who occasionally does still play with Jackson Browne, but played all over all the early tracks. And he's principally known as a slide guitarist, but he's a fantastic sort of rock and roll, country rock fiddle player. And some of those early Jackson Browne songs, there's a fantastic fiddle on them. And when we sat down to do that track, basically, I actually had gone out literally and deliberately played a few old Jackson Browne tracks, you know. And surprise, surprise, that's how the songs come out in terms of its sound. And it is a little bit different. It's ironically, it's the most commercial sounding song on the album, you know. But I'm delighted with the way it comes out. I'm delighted to have been given the opportunity to do that and finally make a track that actually acknowledges one of my heroes, you know, from a musical viewpoint. So,
absolutely, yeah. Tell us a little about some of the other tracks on the album, Phil. There are 7 or 8 songs from Steve, a couple of covers, and a few traditional songs too.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, Steve's material always references traditional music anyway, but Netherlands, you know, I think anyone who puts it on think, it's going to be an unaccompanied folk album, you know, and so on. And then obviously Keys to Canterbury. Keys of Canterbury is harking slightly back to what we were doing on Witness and all the stuff, the work we were doing with Simon Emerson, and then it has a slightly, you know, a sort of sequenced feel to it, although it's not in any way manipulated or sequenced. It's all real playing, you know.
I'll walk along with you anywhere. I will give you the small golden bell, that you may ring your servants and they may serve us well. If you will be my joy, sweet and only dear, and walk along with me anywhere.
Say I won't accept from you your small golden bell, that you may ring our servants and they may serve us well.
I will not be your joy,
and then also, just to give a lie to everything I've said, of course, there's a song like The Veil, which I didn't know. I didn't even know Steve had written it. I turned up to the session and Stuart said, oh, Steve's just put this one down. I believe Steve did it in 2 takes. I listened to the song and thought, what a beautiful song. And so Stuart and I said, what shall we do? And because I've not heard this, I've got no preconceived ideas. And he said, I'd just like to hear some very simple dobro and a sort of fiddle solo. So I think, I believe, I'm right in saying I did no more than 3 passes with the dobro, the resonator guitar. And then I did the fiddle solo. And again, it's the old thing, I was just warming up. So I played the solo and Stuart hit the stop button and said, right, that'll do, that's it. So... Occasionally, you know, the first thing that you do is the right thing, you know, and why mess around with it? And I'm delighted with Stuart's choice, you know, because it really is the most simple and direct song on the album. So.
It's often the case that you can mess around and play with things for so long you lose the initial spontaneity, can't you?
Yeah, yeah. Simon Emerson's tracks that Afrocats used to do, because they're fantastically complex, you know, with hundreds of sequences and overdubs, you know. And he said on occasions they would be mixing a track for 2.5 days and get so bogged down that they couldn't see the wood for the trees, you know. And at that point in time, that's always the point with very complex modern music, that you actually have to stop, get back to zero, and start again, you know. But there's nothing as complex as that on any of this recording, obviously. But I'm just very pleased. I'm very pleased with the way it sounds. You know, great efforts have been made to ensure that every single word on the album is crystal clear, and there's some very, very good songs that Steve's written this time. You know?
So what are the subjects is Steve been venting his spleen about?
Well, you know, you've got the IED is probably the most complex song, because we're all familiar with the phraseology.
Oh, from Afghanistan.
And what it means in terms of terrorist techniques. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he expands on the idea, and, of course, there's a little bit of the business Steve's been through over the last couple of years with the illness of his son, idea that there is also, something genetic inside all of us, or something that can suddenly be triggered and something terrible happens, you know, and drawing parallels between all those things. It's a song that works on many levels, and it's certainly the most powerful song in the set. But I think all songs like that, it will take, you know, it takes 2 or 3 listens to understand what's actually being said, you know. But it's a great song. I do like it very much.
There's something underneath my skin no one can detect. It's time to detonate within with maximum effect. Lying in some secret place, without warning, without trace. The planets and the stars align, and wires will just connect. Science or nature, you're scattering spores and seeds. Before my maker, I'll get down on my knees. Have you an answer or another IED? And if I disarm you, will you let me be? A driver in the darkness nods his head and starts to yawn. We've both been on this journey since the day that we were born. 2 lives on a single track, the plus and minus now attract. Intersecting on my map, an hour before the dawn. Science or nature, scattering spores and seeds.
And then again, it's got the little reference in the Miranda's sort of you looping around with snippets from a traditional folk song. Trees, they do grow high, you know. So that's a complex song. I think you Steve would need to explain it to you fully. I like that one. And then there's just fun songs, you know, like Monopoly, for instance, which is, just about that curious event, you know, when everyone went bonkers for about 2 weeks down at Branscombe near us when the ship was beached and so on.
Did you get anything out of that yourself? You got a BMW motorbike in the shed or anything like that?
No, nothing like that, but... yeah, it is funny how everyone goes a bit bonkers when something like that happens, and no one is clear about the law. No one's clear about, you know, whether people can do stuff like this or not, you know.
Midwinter 2 years ago, Out to the west the storm began to blow, and the word went round to those in the know, the Napoli is gonna run aground.
She's listening, we got out of the docks, 100 containers are heading for the rocks. Gather round lads now, quick out of your blocks, everyone's brands come bound.
Said everyone's brands come bound. Come gangs from the north, lads off the moor, wreckers on the cliff, get down to the shore. Scratch Joe, public, what's underneath? A looter and a pirate and a thief.
A lot of new fences got built down there, I believe, and a lot of woodwork got done just after that, with all the timber that was washed up.
Absolutely, yes,
a
few boats built, I should think. A few
sheds. No coppers on the shore, no, there ain't no coppers on the shore. Come gangs from the north, lads off the moor, wreckers on the cliff.
You mentioned Miranda Sykes, your bass player, and how lucky you are, and all of us are, that Miranda's with Show of Hands, because she's a fantastic musician, and she adds a whole other dimension to the sound that you get.
Oh, yes.
When are you going to make her an official partner and make her part of Show of Hands?
That's one of those difficult things. It can't actually quite be like that, because Show of Hands can ultimately only ever be me and Steve, because that's the way it's constructed, quite apart from the fact that it's basically like all bands trying to take care of business, it's a limited company as well. But Miranda is certainly, we've kind of boxed this one around a lot. We kind of think it's better that it always is, that she's always mentioned, specifically by name, rather than sort of absorbed into the band thing. So every bit of our publicity, all our posters, always mention her by name, because there's all kinds of sides to that. Maybe she won't be with us forever, because I could imagine a very large number of much bigger bands than us coming along and sort of saying, hello, you're claimed, I think we have to say that we're just lucky that she continues to work with us, and we're very happy for that, because it's the only other instrument that can kind of be part of what we do.
The double bass, yeah.
We've steadfastly, apart from one or two times just for fun, when Miranda came into the thing, that was 4 years ago, when we just, for the summer season, put together a band lineup, which we hadn't done before, and it was, just for 7 or 8 gigs, and because we had our old friend Pete Zorn on bass, and of course, Pete's first call is always Richard Thompson, and surprise, surprise, with 2 gigs into it, Richard called up and said, look, I've got this string of gigs, can you come over? So obviously Pete had to jump, and we had to find a bass player pretty quickly. Miranda had already done some gigs with me and my band, so we got her down, and it was obvious, And basically, she's been there ever since. So, she's a huge asset, and she's a great singer, and she's a superb double bass player. It's a great combination, and it works really well, and we're very happy with it. So.
And she has a good dose of glamour as well. I'm sorry, but it has to be said.
Well, there is that as well, She has youth on her side.
Oh, terrific. Now, you mentioned the tour, and when you're not off gallivanting on your yacht, and I thought it was very unfair of Steve to have that line in the song about you're on your yacht and we're on our knees.
Yeah, well, I mean, just remember, it's not my yacht. It's owned and run by a charitable trust,
Oh, excuses, Phil.
I don't have the £1 million it would cost to buy one. So.
No, of course. And you're off on tour again, and when you're not touring with Show of Hands, you're off with Feast of Fiddles or your own band, and that's an incredibly tiring lifestyle to lead. Any tricks that you've picked up over the years to deal with the travelling life?
To deal with the travelling life, there's very various things. Here's a little dodge. In this day and age, everything is up for grabs in terms of things like hotels. You know, you have to stay somewhere. For me, it's very important to have a degree of comfort and privacy on the road, you know. So we don't stint on hotels, but you generally find that actually you think you can't afford a nice hotel, but actually most things are up for negotiation in this day and age. And you often find, if you're prepared to negotiate, that you can get, as they say, a deal. And I think that's helpful. You know, it's very helpful to know that at the end of the night you can either go to the bar and join the party, or you can just go off somewhere that's comfortable and nice. You know, I hardly watch television at home. I only ever watch it when I'm on tour late at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those funny things. You know,
mind you, you're not at home very often, are you?
You say that, but I mean, for me, it's about a half and half thing. I think I'm in exactly half the year. You know, it's a phenomenal number of gigs. I completely agree. And then, of course, you lose days because you end up finishing somewhere miles away and it takes you another day to get home and so on and so forth. But, you know, I do get extremely tired sometimes. But once again, as Steve Knightley points out, you know, he did actually used to teach, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And I would say that I don't do it, and I've never done it, nor will I ever do it, but I would say that trying to engage on a daily basis with five or six classrooms of kids, trying to keep them, you know, occupied, educated and informed, and stop them from killing each other, is probably a harder job than the one we have to do.
Yeah.
I would say, and I do know a lot of teachers, and you know, quite a few close personal friends are teachers, and I do know some of the stress that they go through. And indeed, sadly, I know several teachers who've, you know, knocked it on the head for all of the aforementioned reasons.
Gently I drift out in the hallway, the day's changing shift, with whispering voices and a rumor of light. The rain on the window falls softly tonight. My eyes are so heavy, dreams come so swift, I drift. I've no way of knowing when daylight begins. There's no border between all my blessings and sins. Is judgment suspended for all in this place? My resting state is my state of grace, waiting alone for the dawn light to lift. I dream.
I think, you see, if I refer to the Charlie Watts, thing. So yeah, I've been in this band for 40 years. Yeah, that's 5 years of work and 35 years of hanging around.
Where the river begins, where the sea water ends, you turned and you smiled to where I stood apart and whispered I loved you with all of my heart. Then I woke alone on the edge of this cliff where I drift. I drift. I drift.
This tour is the County Towns Tour, which I think is a great idea, and is a celebration of the old county structure of this country, if you like. And it's a good gimmick, too.
Well, you know, otherwise it's just a bunch of gigs.
Yeah.
So we've got two things to hang it on. Firstly, we have a new album, right? So there's a bunch of songs, you know. Many people haven't heard any of them before. And you're always looking for something. And, of course, then it's the challenge often of finding alternative venues. Because the winter tour generally is the bigger gig, so it's medium-sized theatres and established gigs that we would normally do. This time around, of course, we're playing some larger venues than we would normally play, and we're also playing some smaller ones as well, in order to try and fulfil the remit of playing in a county town, you know. So I think some of them are going to be really interesting, some of the places mm-hmm. we've ended up. So we'll just see, anyway.
Yeah. But I suppose that means that the one place that you're not going to play this time will be London.
Yes.
So I got to ask the question, any plans to return to the Royal Albert Hall or a similar huge venue?
It's a topic for discussion. Once again, it's quite a difficult place to get your hands on. One of the drawbacks about it is that once you've established a date that you can do it, of course, you have to pay a substantial amount of the hire fee in advance, you know, so you have to be sure you've got that money, you know, because at the end of the day, it's just a transaction, you know, there's no mystery about playing at the Albert Hall. It's for hire, but it may take you 2 years to get the date, you know. It's a topic for discussion at this point in time, so... We will do it again at some time in the not-too-distant future.
Great, great. Well, that's all great news, but you mentioned something briefly that's less great news about how your music has sometimes been misinterpreted by people, and I have to refer to the situation with the British National Party selling your music and other people's music through their website. I must say, I'm conflicted personally about this, because obviously I don't want to be associated with the BNP, and if we talk about these things, I think it just gives them more publicity. What's your take on the whole situation, Phil?
I would have said that now up until the point that they actually started to appear in elections. And I sort of think now, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I think there's a question time next week where for the first time the leader of the BNP will be actually on a question time panel. And I think the parties are now finally rising to the occasion. And I think it's inevitable. I just think it is absolutely inevitable. I will tell you a heartwarming story without mentioning any names. A certain young person in the not-too-distant past that I've been associated with, who was on the tall ship's trip, sort of our first stop off and where the racing started was Gdynia in Poland. And this particular young person was heard to trot out all that stuff. Oh, yeah, the Poles, they come and take all our jobs, blah, 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 and all this kind of stuff. So after 4 days actually in Gdynia, surrounded by 2 million Polish people, because everyone descended on Gdynia, and having started to make friends, not least with a few rather nice young Polish girls and so on, was actually heard to utter, "Oh, I don't really want to go. This is a nice place. I'd rather like to live here." <You know>? So I thought, well, yeah, okay. Travel broadens the mind, you know.
Sure, yeah.
And all the rest of it. Now, I'll tell you about Roots. When Steve played me the embryo version of it, the very first draft, as it were, in the studio, which is now quite a long time ago, sat down and listened to it, and I actually said, and Steve will bear me out, I said, "That's a great song, but it's going to be You're Born in the USA." That's
yes.
exactly what it's going to be.
Yeah.
And I could tell straight away, you know, cracking chorus, you're going to get people who don't listen to the verses, who don't take any of that on board. Remember back to Springsteen and all that, you know.
And Reagan's people taking it on as a campaign song, yeah.
They only heard the chorus. They thought it was a patriotic, you know, chest-beating, tub-thumping, yay, we're proud to be American. You know, it's not. It's about a bloke who comes back from from the Vietnam War and to discover that his industry is at an end and he can no longer get a job, you know. That's a very crude synopsis of the song, but that's what it's all about, you know. And actually, the chorus is loaded with irony.
And a minister said his vision of hell is three folk singers in a pub near Wells. Well, I've got a vision of urban sprawl. It's pubs where no one ever sings at all, and everyone stares at a great big screen. Overpaid soccer stars, prancing teams, Australian soap, American rap, S3 English baseball caps. And we don't know your shame before we walk, of the way we look and the way we talk, without our stories or our songs. How will we know where we come from? I've lost St. George in the Union Jack. That's my flag too and I want it back. Seed, bud, flower, fruit, never gonna grow without their roots. Brush, stem, show. We need roots and all away, boys, let them go.
In the end, there's nothing you can do, basically. And also, it's not just right-wing idiots who misinterpreted, or rather just not actually listened to the song. Of course, there's the converse. There's a whole bunch of extremely left-wing people who soundly criticised it as well, and they also haven't listened to it either, you know. So it kind of works both ways, really. But, you know, we talked about it. We even talked about not doing the song anymore, but we thought, no, come on, you know. It's absolutely clear what the song's about to anyone unless they're a complete idiot and they can't read or can't listen, you know. So I see no reason to drop it anywhere. And, you know, that's the way it goes. And then, because, I mean, to a lesser extent, Country Life was criticised. Mm-hmm. It was criticised in several quarters for you know, just being a bit of a rant. But as has always been pointed out, that's actually the nature of the song. That's exactly what it's about, you know. It's based on two or three people, you know, as a lot of characters in songs are. They're not just one person. They're two or three different people sort of joined together to make characters up, just like authors make up characters in books and so on and so forth. But the synopsis of what these characters are about is all the same thing, you know. It is actually extremely hard for kids growing up in extremely rural places to find anywhere to live, you know.
Hmm.
It's not actually going to be a particularly reasonable sort of argument or anything like that, you know. I personally think the song's great and it absolutely gets inside the heads of the people who were kind of the source material for it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sure, yeah.
What was the term that was used? Yes, anti-urban rant, that's right. Okay, we're not going to stop doing that song either, you know, because that's the way it goes. It's a great song and it works, you know.
An everyday story of country life. And the red brick cottage where I was born is the empty shell of a holiday home. Most of the year there's no one there. The village is dead and they don't care. Now we live on the edge of town. Haven't been back since the pub closed down. One man's family pays the price for another man's vision of country life. I'm singing, whoa.
And I guess that this whole situation might produce more music about this situation, about how people try to subvert the meaning behind your songs. Do you think that's possible?
Yep, quite likely. Yeah, but no, on a personal view, you know, if you respect democracy, then I think it's necessary now that everything comes out into the open. You know, I think it's not possible to ignore any of this stuff anymore, and it's better that people are having the debate, you know, and they're having the debate publicly. That's actually democratic, you know, and I think that's a much healthier healthier sort of place for everyone to be in. So yes, I've changed my views in the last year or so. You know, I always was in favour of, no, just don't mention it, because the moment you mention it, it gives such and such a faction publicity. But I think we're beyond that now. So
yeah, it's not an easy situation or an easy answer to yep. come up with. But let's move on to happier things, yeah. because I was reading that you're going to join the musical elite
yeah.
and get your own box set. Is this true?
Actually, it's two box sets, I'm afraid.
Hey, do you get a box to put the box sets in?
Well, this one's been going back and forth for 2 years. The point is that there's too much material, and it's just I've tried to rejig it three or four ways. So yeah, for the second half of this tour, I will have box set one, which is a four disc set. Tons of material, very early material that's never seen the light of day. Some of my very earliest recordings, and quite a lot of band material, bits and pieces. Then a few familiar tracks from various sort of points during my checkered career. some Albion band material. There's quite a few interesting live sets which have also not seen the light of day, and so. Box set one is a four-disc set, and there'll be a DVD in it with some very high-quality footage and indeed some very rough footage as well. But it'll be quite interesting and very diverse. And then sometime probably towards April next year, I'll put box set two out, which will contain a further DVD with a whole bunch of acoustic stuff on it. And then I've still got a vast amount of live band material, which still needs editing, comparing, and mixing from a tour 2 years ago when we just went out with a 48 track and recorded every single gig, basically. And that's a big job, and I need to sort of get a month clear to actually go through that and sort of get it all working. So
you want to sail away to a desert island somewhere?
Well, that'd be good. I think a boat with a recording studio. That'd be good.
Yeah, who's got one of those? You want to get yourself sorted? Yeah. Dave Gilmore of Pink Floyd, he's got one of those, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to try that one out? That'd be really good. Listen, Phil, it's been really great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
And we wish you all the best with the tour and with the album. And all our best goes to you and to Steve and Miranda and everybody in the Show of Hands family, of course. Thanks very much for talking to Folkcast, Phil.
Thank you very, very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, Phil Beer.
Cheers.
Evolution or creation, tracks of proof or songs of praise, a billion years of transformation, or fully formed in 7 days. Research, revelation, evidence, indoctrination, in the stars or in the past. Know your colors to the mind. Yeah, I sing for evolution.
Need a visionary solution.
Oh, the origin of the species.
All the life that never ceases.
Be the victory for mankind.
Emancipate the mind.
A finger points in one direction. That's natural selection. Take one note within a chord, then in the distance, barely heard. The need for change, growing stronger. It's not hands, it's home no longer. Here's the key to all creation. Survival equals modulation. In the stars or in the past.
Know your colors to the mind.
Yeah, I sing for evolution.
Need a visionary solution.
Oh, the origin of the species.
All the life that never ceases.
Yeah.
That's natural selection.
Thank you for listening to this independent podcast from Folkcast, bringing you the best in folk, folk rock, singer-songwriter, and roots-based music. Our special guest was Phil Beer, and the show was presented and produced by me, Phil Widows. Please see the websites www.folkcast.co.uk and www.showofhands.co.uk for further details of the new album, titled Arrogance, Ignorance and Greed, and for Show of Hands tour dates. And so until the next time we put our folky fingers into your digital ear holes, this is Phil Widows saying keep focused on Folkcast and bye-bye!